timeless, stylistic, art historical cycles. Five stages of Reinhardt's. Classic black square, uniform, 5 foot. Timeless trisected evanescences of the early 60s. Statement as question. Reinhardt despised the positivist dependence on fact. Witness how the succeeding languages of criticism have slid off his ultimate paintings. Neither the mystical guesswork of the 60s nor the tautological categorics of the 70s can take a hold on them. Why? Because paradoxical clarity exposes compromise. More is less, less is more. The ultimate paintings pose as many questions as do Reinhardt's statements. To attack the rational, use the rational form, the measurable logic of geometry. Use fact and statement to invoke contradiction. Art is art, life is life, but the end of art is art as art. Reinhardt used the rational language of the West to subvert the superficiality of its logic. He had a vision of art, and it verged on metaphor, the metaphor for a vast, coherent symbolism stripped of all trappings, beyond the rules and the dogma so solemnly accepted, and fundamentally free. The next revolution in art will see the Universal Academy of Art free itself from its mercantile fantasies and emerge as a centre of an awakening of the consciousness and of the practice of consciousness. It will see the formation of a Ministry of Fine Arts that will be the main support of an insupportable art. Art in the form of a programme for art, or as a plan for art, will be the climbing plant of the socialist greenhouse, instead of being as it is today the pruned tree of the restrictions of free enterprise. The next revolution in art will see the recognition of the unalienable right of each art to be independent of all the other arts, to be free to be itself, to be free of itself. That was Reinhardt's vision. The Auto interview of 1965 demonstrates just how much will have to be swept away.
Ad Reinhardt was born on Christmas Eve, on the eve of Europe's entry into the First World War, the year of the climax of Cubism and the birth of abstract art, the year of the first large exhibition of modern art in America, the Armory Show. You're the only painter who's been a member of every avant-garde movement in art in the last 30 years, aren't you? I asked him in his Greenwich Village loft studio where Lower Broadway meets Waverly Place. Yes, he said. You were a vanguard pre-abstract expressionist in the late 30s, a vanguard abstract impressionist in the middle 40s, and a vanguard post-abstract expressionist in the early 50s, weren't you? I asked. Yes, he said. You were the first painter to get rid of vanguardism, weren't you? I asked. Yes, he said. Are these rags here your paint rags? I asked, pointing to some rags full of paint on the floor by the window overlooking the street. Yes, he said. Is it true that for 12 years since the early 50s, you've painted only black paintings, and then for 5 years since the early 60s, you've made black paintings of only one size, 5 feet by 5 feet, I asked. Yes, he said. Is this the bench you paint on, these the bottles you mix paints in, these the brushes you paint with, I asked. Yes, he said. You use oil on canvas, Beaucour on Belgian linen, I asked. Yes, he said. You went round the world once, didn't you, I asked. Yes, he said. You're having, I see, your first three-gallery, one-man show in March, or your 18th, 19th, and 20th one-gallery, one-man shows at the same time. Is that right, I asked. Yes, he said. You're showing, I hear, your pioneering and prophetic red and blue monochrome and symmetrical paintings of the early 50s in two galleries, and your heroic black square breakthrough paintings of the early 60s in the third gallery, I asked. Yes, he said. You say, I've read, that you were born the year Clive Bell's book Art was published and that you've been writing Art as Art dogma since you were 39 years old? I asked. Yes, he said. You were 29 when Henri Faucillon's The Life of Forms in Art was published, and you were 49 when George Kubler's The Shape of Time came out, right? I asked. Yes, he said. This new part of your art as art dogma looks like the same old thing. Are you still saying one thing you say needs to be said over and over again, and that this thing is the only thing for an artist to say? I asked. Yes, he said. There's nothing else to say? I asked. No, he said.
There exists at the moment within art the need to stand back from the practice of defining, creating, or extending formal categories. In doing so, artists have sought the aid of other disciplines in order to establish frameworks of reference. As a philosopher, how do you feel philosophy can be and is being used in relation to art?
You're really asking me two questions there. One is how it is being used, and the other how it can be. As regards how it is being used, I'm not as well up as I might be, because I haven't read all the literature. I can explain why, if you'd like to ask me. Can be. Well, there doesn't seem to me to be any way in which one can circumscribe this. I would say that every artist, in some sense, is using some philosophical ideas. But again, I'd like to distinguish between taking philosophy as it's expounded by philosophers of the first, second, or third order. By that I mean, take a person like Kant, he would be the first order, and somebody commenting on him would be of the second order, and somebody commenting on the person commenting on Kant would be the third order, and so on. Now, I'm not sure that very much help can be got from taking philosophy as it's handed down by philosophers or commentators on philosophers. But at all times there are philosophical ideas floating around, and I think these can be quite influential. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the Renaissance was a time when, in the court of the Medici, there was a great deal of Neoplatonic philosophy in the air. And at the beginning of this century, there seemed to be a lot of philosophical or quasi-philosophical ideas floating about in Paris. Now, I think these had some influence on artists, an indirect influence. And so the answer to your question is that how can it? I think indirectly it can. I don't think it can do it directly. To take just a personal example, I was very interested in the use that Eduardo Palazzi made of Wittgenstein. But when I talked to him about it, it was completely unclear what exactly this influence was. Well, one thing was clear, that the life of Wittgenstein, Wittgenstein writing his Tractatus while at the front, things like that did influence him. And certain ideas of Wittgenstein obviously influenced him. But what ideas they were and what interpretation Eduardo put on them, I could never get clear. And that's why I say that taking philosophy directly from philosophers doesn't seem to me to be very fruitful.
Could you comment upon the more direct use philosophy is being put to by some artists working at the moment?
That was the question about what is being done.
Yes.
Now, as I say, I'm not as well up in this as I might be, but I could give you a reason why I'm not. I have read some things in art language, and when one spends one's whole day teaching philosophy, discussing philosophy, reading Wittgenstein or Austin or something of this kind, and then one comes across a very curious use of this, to put it mildly, one just hasn't got the mental energy to wade through it. I have here an excerpt from an article by Kossuth, in which he talks about Ayres' definition or exposition
of Kant's distinction between a priori analytic and synthetic judgments. Yes. Now, I mean, why not give us Kant? I suppose Kant's more obscure than air. But what he does with this is to use this as an analogy for his idea of art. And he says that art is like an analytic proposition as defined by air in exposing Kant. Now, that's something that I can understand.
If you take philosophy as giving you analogies on which you can work, that's fine. But most of the people that I've read aren't clear that this is what they're doing. They seem to think that they are taking philosophy pure and somehow applying it. Whereas I think what they are doing is taking philosophical analogies. And that's fine, I've got no quarrel with this. My only trouble is that I'm just too close to both art and philosophy to be able to go along with it.
Do you believe the process of change within art to take place according to the Gombrich-Popperian definition, that is, through the growth and accumulation of knowledge, or through the process defined by Kuhn, describing the way in which science evolves, that is, through the constant creating and replacement of frameworks or paradigms?
Well, could I ask you if your question could be rephrased this way? Is my view that the development of art is a continuum or a sort of quantum? In other words, does it go forward by leaps or does it go forward with sort of a smooth, continuous process? If that is your question, then I think I come down on the side of leaps and quanta. Yeah. Of course, I suppose one can say both sort of things happen. But for the most part, it's a continuous development, as though somebody had got hold of a seminal idea and was working it through and modifying it, improving on it, and so on. But nevertheless, there are periods when there are leaps and jumps which cannot be fitted in any logical way into what went before. And I think that this is the case in anything that's really creative. But it's true of precisely. I mean, in Kuhn's description of science. But I'm not sure that designating that as non-Popperian is, you know, perfectly accurate. Because in fact, Popper himself admits that how people come by new ideas, seminal ideas, is a psychological mystery. Mm. If these are two views, then I come down on the side of the sudden and inexplicable leaps.
Could you say what position you feel the critic now occupies in relation to art?
Well, I think that the function of the art critic, and by that I don't mean that there is a special person who's an art critic as opposed to an artist. I mean, an artist can be just as good a critic as an art critic. And in fact, I've found that a lot of artists are better critics of other artists' work, not necessarily of their own, but of other artists' works, than a lot of critics. But the function of the critic, that, as I understand it, is that he makes explicit certain things which are implicit in most other people's reactions. He helps, particularly when a new movement or a new manifestation has come along, to try and say what people feel about it, which they can't articulate. And so, as somebody in a recent book put it extremely well, to dig a channel through the mudflats through which everybody else can sail. You see, something new comes along. This particular author who I'm thinking about was talking about his first reaction to Jasper Johns' work. And he had no time for it at all. I mean, he said ridiculous nonsense. I mean, flags, targets, noses in boxes. I mean, what sort of thing is this? Nevertheless, he felt that there was something there. And so he struggled extremely hard to try and come to terms with this. And I think he came to terms with it very well. Whereas lots of people were saying, oh, how marvelous. But they were only saying, oh, how marvelous, because it was new. They didn't know what it was about any more than he did. But when he had done his analysis, and he published about three articles on Jasper Johns, then one now
had a firmer grasp of what it was that Jasper Johns was on about and why one felt that Jasper Johns was important.
Could I go back to the second question, in fact, which was to do with the growth of knowledge? At the moment, anyway, there seems to be a need on the part of artists to find out a lot more about their own position or context, whereas in other periods, one can think of, a lot of questions were answered for them by outside factors. Looking at this need to be informed, artists have become interested in other areas of knowledge, and you mentioned the Renaissance, which was interesting. Can one draw analogies with this and other periods in this respect?
Well, yeah, I think that at any period when art has flourished, there has been a very fruitful exchange between the artists and other sources of knowledge. And I think this is eminently true today. The only thing that worries me about the artists today is that they seem to spend too much time thinking about what they're supposed to be doing rather than doing it. And that really isn't their business. I mean, if you decide to spend your time thinking about what art is, then you're no longer an artist and you've become a philosopher or something.
But surely that's taken place because of a need. A model of activity for the artist doesn't exist. Therefore, isn't it appropriate, in fact, in order to formulate a position, there's a need to stand back?
Well, you see, there are two things here. You can either do what Fellini did in 8 and a half, if you remember. I assume that when Fellini made 8 and a half, he didn't know what he was going to make his next picture about. So he made a picture about a film director who didn't know what he was going to make his next picture about. That's fine. If you don't know, you know, what art is all about, and you make a work of art about somebody who doesn't know what art is all about,
yes,
that's grand. If you start sitting down and discussing first principles, you know, what is art all about,
yes,
then I don't think you're producing a work of art.
Yes.
Now, I think that, in fact, what these artists are doing is much more the second than the first, because their great-grandfather is Marcel Duchamp, who didn't really ask what art is all about, but turned a urinal on its end and signed it R. Mutt, thereby raising questions about art, but raising questions about art by doing something which was artistic. It's very different from me in a seminar saying, that urinal a work of art or not? And if it is, why? And if it's not, why? I mean, that wasn't what Duchamp did. He questioned what art was, but he made the questioning of art. He wouldn't say it was a work of art, but when he wouldn't say it was a work of art, what he meant was it wasn't a work of art as traditionally understood at that time. I think it's a work of art as understood now. So if we keep these two things distinct, the questioning which becomes itself a work of art and the questioning which stands back from the work of art, then I would say, yes, there is a lot of questioning, but this questioning is part of the artwork itself. But I think this is the way in which art has always been going. Well, maybe not in a continuous line, but artists have always been questioning themselves. And this questioning has itself brought about the development in art.
Led to other thoughts, to a sort of positive statements.
And, you know, another thing, the funny thing about it is that, which nobody seems to emphasize in the history of books of art, that nearly every new work of art is non-art.
Mm-hmm.
You see, after all, if you take in the Middle Ages or the early Renaissance, you paint a Madonna and child with a few saints and a patron or two. And in the background, you have a beautiful meadow or a Tuscan landscape or something of that kind. And maybe in the foreground you have a table with a bowl of flowers and some fruit. Right, well now, that's okay. The landscape is background, the flowers are decoration in the foreground. And then you go on and you make a painting which has got nothing else but landscape, and a painting which has got nothing else but fruit and flowers. I mean, what kind of a painting is this? This isn't art. I mean, it's just taking the what is on the periphery of art
and making it a work of art. And but then this becomes accepted and it becomes landscape and still life. And then you go on and do something else, which isn't art, and you end up by sort of painting a uniform canvas, blue or red. And somebody said, well, that's not art. I mean, that's just painting it blue or red is just what you do before you begin to paint a picture. You see? So in a sense, every time you move forward in art, you move into what is non-art.
Systems Approach to Art and Design Education, an introduction. Let me start by saying that I'm of the opinion that the collection of people and resources in one location for the purpose of educating and training artists and designers still has a relevance and a potential desperately needed at this stage of the 20th century. Design education should not yet be de-schooled. In fact, just the opposite. More and more people should be encouraged to take advantage of information available in art and design schools about the problems of the processes of design in order that their participation in the planning and organization of their future environment may be made more effective. Some sectors of further education can be successfully developed by transmitting information through various media to the home-based student. The excellent courses presented by the Open University are a splendid example. But I'm of the opinion that the complexity of the problems of art and design education can still be constructively helped by continuing to use the more traditional method of continuous personal interaction between artist, designer, and student. Since many art and design institutions hold this belief, it may be incorrectly deduced that I'm about to purvey the usual and reactionary attitude that is prevalent in so much of design education today. On the contrary, I would like to propound that with collection of personnel and resources in one place, coupled with information available on such topics as organization theory and design methods, there could come into being a totally new and dynamic understanding of education generally, design education in particular, and a greater understanding than at present of the effects of the products of the process of design. How can we bring about this transformation? I'd like to suggest that the adoption of a systems approach has a great deal to offer to the designers of design education. Before talking about this approach to art and design education in particular, it is perhaps necessary to explain something of systems generally. The word systems is so general that it's very difficult to define in precise terms. The word is used sometimes to refer to a collection of interrelated objects or things which are viewed as a whole, such as a system of rivers, a transport system. The word can also be used to mean a collection of rules, what we might call a generating system. For instance, a betting system aims to generate winnings. A marshalling yard system aims to generate trains with its trucks in a certain sequence. A prefabrication system aims to generate different types of structure from standard components. Systems are ubiquitous. They are found at both extremes of the size scale. The solar system is a vast assembly containing our planets and sun. At the other extreme are cell systems and atomic systems. There are natural systems which work on their own without human intervention. For example, weather systems, forest systems, and many others. But of course, as we know, these can be affected by man-machine systems. But we are not concerned here with natural phenomena. We are concerned with a system that is under human control. So we can now state from our point of view that a system can be described as 1. A collection of interrelated elements. 2. A set of rules governing their interrelationships. 3. The system must be under human control. And 4. We must be able to analyze it. That is, either its structure and or its behavior. A number of further general statements are necessary. The first of these concerns the relationship of the system with its environment, that is, with the world about it. Some do not interact with their surroundings and have no relationship with their environment. These are described as closed systems. Most organic systems are just the opposite, for it's necessary for their survival for them to interact with their environment. Such systems that require an interchange of matter and information with their environment are described as open systems. Business organizations are examples of open systems, since they depend for their continued existence on their interaction with their environment. Educational systems are another example. But it all too often appears that art and design education is having considerable difficulties in designing what interrelationships it should have and with which elements of the larger environment. Many open systems have the quality of being adaptive. This means they interact with their environment in such a way as to favour their continued existence. Being adaptive is a main requirement of art and design education. Yet again, it appears that this necessity is not understood. Witness the reduction in the number of art and design schools in the last decade. As the environment changes, so much the system in question. An educational organization is composed of subsystems. And by viewing art and design education from a systems approach, we're able to interrelate such subsystems as educational philosophy with resources, resources with planning, planning with evaluation, and so on. It is, of course, vital that we promote more efficient usage of our scarce resources, bearing in mind that our resources include our students, that is, the artists and designers of the future. One way to avoid the financial, political, and philosophical crises which have been so destructive of art and design education is to adopt a systems approach that allows objectives to be determined, giving rise to a stability that allows a system to be adaptive and dynamic. For years, there has been a confusion between stasis and stability. This approach generates a more humane and democratic attitude by careful and detailed inquiry into its environment and its own structure and behaviour. Indeed, a systems approach demands participatory planning. Improved efficiency should not be confused with efforts to reduce public spending on art and design education. It is not a cost reduction device. Indeed, to be able accurately to describe what one does and why could result in increased financial support. Another important aspect of the systems approach is that it overcomes fragmentations caused by specialization and tends to integrate individual contributions and encourage the development of an holistic view. Of course, a systems approach may well be viewed with suspicion, but it's important to underline the fact that it does provide a flexible tool for all kinds of situations, particularly important where it aids identifying when original thinking is necessary and where established methods are available. But conflict should be recognized as a healthy organizational symptom, not something to be suppressed, but faced. You will remember that earlier I said that one of the properties of systems is that we must be able to analyze it. So how do we make an analysis of our system? We begin by determining our environment. In our case, it is particularly complex in that not only do we have the whole of education as part of our environment, but also many other aspects of life are affected by the outcome of the design activity, an extremely important aspect to be coped with when drawing our environment. Designing means thinking before acting, so as to avoid any unforeseen and undesirable effect of the act of designing. The same is true of the design of design education. What are the inputs, process components, and outputs of the art and design instructional system? The primary inputs are the students, who also represent the system output. Inputs may be either objects or persons to be transformed by the system, or the total input of men, materials, and information that enable the system to function. The input, then, are acted upon by the process components. These components can be analyzed in terms of the elements, that is, the men, materials, and equipment, and the functions of these elements, that is, what each does. Outputs are represented by students whose behavior as measured on entry has, it is assumed, been altered in some way. In education, the achievement of certain standards and criteria are measured by assessment based upon the various aims and objectives of the system. The standard of acceptability may be both internal and external. In order to define the changes from input to output, it is necessary first to define the input characteristics and the system's goals and objectives. This assumes that the objectives can be stated and measured, and indeed the ability to be capable of doing this is crucial to the future development of art and design education. It also assumes that the measures are valid, reliable, and acceptable. A great deal of work is still necessary in this highly sensitive area. One cannot adequately assess achievement of standards if the standards themselves are inadequately defined. There's a frightening reluctance in art and design institutions to face up to the difficulties of clearly defining objectives. But if it's not attempted immediately, the art and design sector of further education will remain depressed and lacking in any confidence, which in turn will lead to further cuts. Program learning can make a considerable contribution to this problem, in that it is shown that the definition of short-term objectives are a great help towards solving the problem of being able to state long-term objectives. So how do we determine the pertinent objectives? We have to adopt the strategy of working backwards, that is, first identifying which purpose the system to be designed has to fulfill, and from a description of the mission of the system, draw implications for its design and work steadily towards increasingly greater detail. One of the most positive arguments for a system's concept of organization is the environment within which art and design education exists is becoming increasingly unstable as a result of rapid growth of technology and changes in social and political systems. A systems approach enables designers and teachers of art and design to isolate and identify problems, select optimal strategies, and evaluate their effectiveness. A systems approach will help avoid progressive but isolated educational change that so often causes an imbalance in the overall system. Although change and innovation are so often unpopular and viewed with suspicion by teachers, a system approach helps to introduce a realism, a professionalism, and expertise that is desperately needed in art and design education today.